Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with My Opel, rewarding loyalty and taking care of members.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
I'm joined in the studio now by Roderick O'Gorman, Minister for Children, Equality, Disability, Integration and Youth and Green Party TD for Dublin West. Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Claire. Thanks for having me on.
So you launched this white paper earlier this year on ending direct provision and changing the way that we provide housing and other services for applicants, who people who are applying for international protection. And today you're announcing the three people who will serve on the advisory group to oversee the process. So who are those people?
So the people are Catherine Day, who, as we know, wrote a really fundamentally important report on direct provision a number of years ago, setting out how we could end the system, and from whom my white paper takes a lot of influence. The other members are David Donoghue, who's a former Irish ambassador and has a lot of experience in international human rights and immigration law. And then we have Lorcan Sir, who, as we know, is an expert in housing. And I think those three pillars are so important in terms of the key things that we need to do to deliver the white paper to end direct provision. Housing will be essential, reforms to immigration will be essential, and an overall understanding of how direct provision works at the moment.
So what's the job of those three people?
Their job, I suppose, is to hold my feet to the fire and to make sure that we deliver on the commitments in the white paper. So they're an independent external group. They'll provide periodic reports on the progress of achieving the various goals set out in the white paper, and they'll make those reports public. They'll also have an availability to highlight if they see concerns, if they see issues, if they see delays. And I think that's about trying to build trust in this process as well, because I know from talking to people in direct provision, they haven't trusted government to make those changes necessary. So this is showing to people living in direct provision right now and to the NGO sector, who were very involved in the drafting of the white paper, that it's not just a question of leave it to me, leave it to the government to get it done. There is this independent group who will be keeping a very close eye on the various commitments.
So housing obviously is a major issue when you're discussing ending direct provision. Lorcan Sir, as you say, is on this advisory group. The Housing for All plan, though, doesn't have much in there when it comes to ending direct provision. Are you disappointed in that?
No, we work closely with Minister O'Brien, and it is referenced in the Housing for All. And the housing needs for people in the international protection system has to be addressed within the wider context of addressing the housing crisis in this country. And that was always understood between our two departments from the start.
It's pretty wishy-washy, though. It says that Dara O'Brien's housing department will liaise with your department and local authorities will attempt to house around 2,900 people, but there's almost 7,000 people in direct provision.
Well, let me talk about something that's concrete, and that's the engagement between my department and the housing agency. So the housing agency has huge expertise in terms of procurement, in terms of delivery, in the terms of designing schemes whereby approved housing bodies can bid for capital funding to actually undertake building. And my department are deeply engaged with the housing authority right now. And indeed, the former CEO of the Housing Authority, John O'Connor, who was just retired recently, is coming on board the programme board. So he'll be part of my department's team. So that sort of expertise will both be within my department, but will also be sourced through the housing agency as well. So we're looking at the various ways that we can, whether it's procurement initially, whether it's tendering to ask approved housing bodies to bid for pieces of capital that they can actually go and start building and providing this housing themselves. Mm. So we're looking at all those options.
Do the people working on the Housing for All plan, including the minister, push back against further commitments for
no,
direct provision?
No. As I say, it was a close working relationship, and Minister O'Brien and his team would have been very much involved with the drafting.
So you're happy with
this
commitment just to liaise with you and attempt to house 2,900 people?
I'm happy with the close cooperation that's happening right now between our departments, and it was the Minister for Housing who actually suggested that he'd open up the expertise of the Housing Authority to my department, and that's been incredibly beneficial. And the Housing Authority actually have a team within there working just on supporting the white paper. That's really valuable.
What about the Land Development Agency? You wanted the Land Development Agency involved in this, but the Department of Housing said no.
Well, look, I think in the context of the drafting of the legislation on the Land Development Agency, we raised a question about whether there was a room for a specific strand there. We discussed this with the Department of Housing. The Department of Housing was clear that in terms of the Land Agency's ability maybe to be off books, that they couldn't provide specific strands within it. But look, the range of housing solutions that will be needed to house people in the international protection system, they're going to come from a number of sources. Mm. They'll come through approved housing bodies. They'll come,
but not from the Land Development Agency. And you wanted that to happen, and it didn't happen.
It was an issue that we looked at in the context of looking for solutions. I'm very satisfied that the range of solutions that we've identified in the white paper and we're working on developing now will give us the necessary housing.
Okay, so you're looking for, or what you want to do is have 6 state-run reception centres, and applicants would spend no longer than 4 months?
Yeah, the reception and integration centres where applicants will spend up to 4 months, and where there'll be a range of support services for them in terms of English language supports, in terms of integration with employment services, in terms of childcare, in terms of TUSLA. So bring all those services together for applicants.
And then after four months,
they'll move into accommodation in communities across the country.
And the cost, the estimated cost, 220 million to build the centres, 235 to 450 million then to provide accommodation in local communities. Do you have the budget supports from your colleagues, Pascal Donoghue, Michael McGrath?
We had a clear commitment in the programme for government to provide the current and the capital spending to implement that plan. That was reiterated when the white paper was adopted by the government, and it will be reiterated within the context of the NDP as well. And there'll be a specific reference to the government's commitment to end direct provision.
So your biggest battle here is to get your priorities up the pecking order when it comes to budget.
Well, look, I think that's a battle every department always has at budgetary time. But look, as I say, it's referenced in the programme for government. It's referenced in the white paper, which it was adopted by the entire government. And I believe there'll be a clear reference to it in the context of the NDP.
Probably not the best moment in time, though, to be asking for money for this, given that we're in a housing crisis and then there's all the COVID supports to be paid for as well.
Well, look, I suppose a Minister for Public Expenditure will always point to the pressure that he or she is under. And there's always going to be pressure. What I think, though, is that government, all parties to government, and indeed, I think most people in the country recognise that we need to end direct provision. It's a system that doesn't serve us well as a country in terms of our human rights obligations, doesn't serve the needs of the people in it, and people want it to end, and I'm committed to doing that.
It has been suggested that down the line we will see tribunals of inquiry into how we as a country have treated people who live in direct provision, and some of whom have lived in direct provision for years. Do you believe that will happen?
I don't know if that's the case. I suppose my focus is on ending it and on improving conditions for people who are in the system right now. And that's what I need to do. I have this opportunity. I have the support of my party, of my government colleagues. And that's where my focus is.
So you see that it's wrong. You know, can you see that we will look back down the line and say, what was going on there?
Well, and that's why I'm trying to end it. Mm-hmm. And that was a Green Party proposal that we brought into these programme for government negotiations. We've spoken with people in the process, but I think we've spoken to the public as well, because I think we've seen over the 20 years that direct provision has been in place, the huge public reaction against it. And look, the Irish people are open and generous, and you know, I'm seeing that right now in the context of the work we're doing to support refugees coming in from Afghanistan as well. People understand that those who are fleeing crises in their own countries deserve support, and deserve support that's centred on equality and human rights.
And the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission has expressed concern about the slippage in the implementation of your white paper, that it's already meant delays, people continuing to languish in the system. This is what Sinead Gibney said from the IHREC. What is your response to that? That this not only is going on too long, as in over the 20-year period, but even since your white paper was published, not much has happened.
Well, I wouldn't agree not much has happened. IREC raised issues in terms of the accessibility of driver's licences and the vulnerability assessment. Driver's licences is a bit delayed. That has to be done through primary legislation, and Minister Ryan will be bringing that legislation forward in this term. In terms of vulnerability assessments, these were required under EU law since 2018. They're an assessment when someone arrives in the country of what specific supports they need. And we didn't do that for 4 years until this year. I asked my department to put in the person power, to put in the finances to start to undertake vulnerability assessments. They've been undertaken on new arrivals since February. Almost 800 vulnerability assessments have taken place this year, and they are identifying the particular needs of individuals, whether it's perhaps a disability, whether it's they underwent some particular trauma in their journey.
And are those needs addressed then when they're identified?
We are now in a position to address those needs in terms of when they're in the system.
Something else I want to ask you about, which you're responsible for, two reports this week that access to the redress scheme for survivors of mother and baby homes will be expanded beyond the recommendations of the Commission for Investigation. Is that something you have been considering?
Well, look, we're in the final stages of agreeing the redress proposals. I wrote to survivors earlier this week to say I hope to bring the proposals to government in early October, and I'll inform survivors immediately once I've got the agreement of government. And I don't want to get into as we're in the final stages, I don't want to get into the ins and outs of what the final package will look like. But look, I'm very clear, we've done a lot of work on this over the last number of months. We've engaged with survivors. We undertook a significant consultation with survivors to get an understanding from them about what they wanted to see in the package, but also how it will work as well.
Yeah,
because
previous
schemes were very hard to access for survivors, and some survivors actually described them as re-traumatising, and I don't want this scheme to repeat those mistakes.
But the ins and outs of the proposed changes to what was recommended by the Commission, they've already been reported on, leaving people in a limbo again, waiting to hear whether they're going to be included or not. You can understand that that is very difficult. You talk about re-traumatising. I mean, here we go again.
And that's why I wrote to survivors early this week and just indicated that nothing final had been agreed. As you know, when the government took the decision to start this interdepartmental group to draw up the redress scheme, it did make the clear decision that it wouldn't have to be bound by the criteria that were set out by the Commission of Investigation, that it could look beyond that. And as I say, a lot of work has taken place over the summer, and I hope to bring those proposals to government very soon.
There are indications that this redress scheme could cost up to €1 billion to provide even modest redress to survivors. Do you agree with that estimate?
Again, I don't want to speculate on figures at this stage. And my focus has been on designing a scheme that meets the needs of survivors.
Okay. You wrote in January to the Catholic Church leaders, the Church of Ireland leaders, six Catholic congregations that ran homes or were linked to this. Did you hear back from them?
I did. We heard back from all of them. And we made a determination subsequent to that we would design the scheme first, because designing the scheme and getting the scheme right is the central
goal. Is that what they suggested?
No, it's not what they suggested. It was a decision by myself and my department. So as soon as the scheme is finally agreed and published, we'll meet with the various congregations and with the primates in terms of seeking their contribution.
What did they say in their responses to you?
They all agreed that they would meet with me. In my initial letter to them, I'd spoken to them about contribution to a redress scheme, about an apology, and also about provision of any documents or information that they might have. A number of them have issued apologies subsequently, and we will be speaking to them in terms of their contribution to redress and the accessibility of documents of information they have. Mm. And obviously, as you know, we're doing a much wider piece of work about access to information, the Information and Tracing Bill that's before the Joint Oireachtas Committee for pre-legislative scrutiny at the moment.
One of your cabinet predecessors, Alan Shatter, said at one stage, I think it was back in 2013 or 14, I can't drive a tank up to these churches and demand money from them. If an order refuses now to cooperate or contribute in any way, is there anything that you can do?
Well, look, I hope that orders will understand the necessity for them to acknowledge what happened in institutions that they ran. The state has accepted that. The state accepted that in the context of the Taoiseach's apology, in the context of the redress scheme that's being designed, in the context of bringing forward access to information now, and in the other actions that we set out after the Commission's report. So now it's up to the orders for them to recognise what they've done, and one of the best ways they can do that is through contributing to this scheme.
But you can't compel them.
Well, look, I don't want to, you know, prejudge an engagement and prejudge a negotiation at this point. I want to have those discussions, but I did feel it was important that that the redress scheme wasn't, you know, reliant or dependent on the engagement of the institute of the orders. The redress scheme is designed with the best interests of survivors in mind.
Coming back to the news of the day, and we were just talking to Niamh O'Byrne from the HSE Testing and Tracing about this radical change to how children are going to be treated if they're close contacts. Now, Elaine Dunn is chair of the Federation of Early Childhood Providers. She was on Morning Ireland. She's concerned about the decision to allow asymptomatic children who are close contacts to stay in creche. And she said it could lead to potential closures. Are you going to issue guidance to the sector?
We will. We obviously received this notification from NEFID yesterday, and we're engaging with them, and we'll be sending out guidance and an FAQ document to the sector either this evening or at very latest tomorrow morning. We're just engaged clarifying a couple of points with NEFID and the HSE at the moment. We've always, when significant public health decisions have been made, we've always engaged with our sector, and our sector has done an amazing job, you know, since the return of the childcare at large scale at the start of September. The positivity rate in childcare has only been 4%. It was 3% last week. And that's because the way in which childcare professionals have implemented the public health guidance across settings.
Can you understand why they're concerned, though, this morning?
Look, it's a significant change. And, you know, I think settings are used to implementing the public health rules as they were. We have to remember the pod system is still in place. The wearing of masks is still in place. The general rules around hygiene are still in place. And they're the really important rules in terms of keeping children and also keeping childcare professionals, keeping them safe.
Were you surprised when you saw this coming through last night?
I spoke about it with Minister Donnelly yesterday. As you say, it is a significant change, but it's also a recognition that, you know, all of us have that bonus from the fact that the public health situation is improving. But children who we all recognise have suffered in terms of the long gaps in school earlier this year and last year, and now children who are asymptomatic but are close contacts up to this point weren't able to attend school or childcare for up to 10 days, and that interruption is significant, and I think it is an important further step in the return to normality that won't be happening anymore.
It might have been helpful if there was a greater lead-in time, because, you know, it's been drilled into us, if your child has symptoms you keep them home from school or creche. If your child is a close contact, they're out and they have to be tested and all of that. And now this about turn is happening Wednesday, we're told about it, and it's in place on Monday. Do you think in terms of communication and bringing people along, it might have been better to give it even a week or so?
Well, look, I suppose when we have clear public health guidance, then that is valid from that point. And look, you know, I was listening to to Niamh O'Byrne earlier on, who I think did communicate what the changes are, but also the rationale behind it in a really clear manner. So look, I see this as part of that return to normality, and seeing that children, that young people can start to enjoy the benefits of the much improved public health situation across the country.
Minister, thank you very much for coming in. Minister Roderick O'Gorman, Minister for Children and Integration. Thank you.
Thanks.